Normally, when a prison sentence ends, the prisoner is released, having done his or her time. But there is a provision in Wisconsin law, Chapter 980, that provides a possibility for the state to hold a prisoner beyond their designated release date. The law is nicknamed Turner's Law, after Gerald Turner Jr., Fond du Lac's infamous Halloween killer. Turner was due for release on Wednesday, but he remains incarcerated. It's Friday, February 9th. This is the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm Dean Kallenbach. Kate Archer-Kent has the day off. Gerald Turner would like to live in Madison following his release, or the Madison area, but the state attorney general's office is fighting against the release of Turner, who killed a 9-year-old trick-or-treater back in 1973. We'll look at the circumstances in the Turner case, but also explore this law designed to keep dangerous people off the street. Are you comfortable with Gerald Turner being released, or should he be committed? How would you feel if a violent sexual offender moved into your neighborhood? You're welcome to join the conversation. Call 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org, or tweet at WPR Mornings. Our guest for these next few minutes is the sheriff of Dane County, Dave Mahoney. Dave Mahoney, thank you for joining us.
Good morning, and thank you for the invitation.
Well, Gerald Turner has apparently shown interest in returning to the Madison area should he be released. He was released on parole in 1998 and then reincarcerated in 2002 for a violation of that parole. But the 4 years between, he did spend in the Madison area. You're quoted as saying you're concerned about this particular case. What is your concern?
Well, my concern is, although I understand that Turner has reached his mandatory release date, he has not shown that during his term of incarceration, and certainly while he was out on supervised release, that he continues to seek out pornography and other means of access to both adult and potentially child pornography, which concerns me that he'll be unsupervised in our community now that he's no longer under the supervision of Department of Corrections.
Yeah, his parole violation in that got him back in prison in 2002 actually related to viewing pornography. You were joined this past Monday morning by police officials from the town of Madison, Middleton, and Monona, saying it was crucial to inform the public of Turner's plans. What advice do you have for people in those communities who could potentially wind up being his neighbors?
Well, our intent for making that notification is the same process that we use whenever an individual who's been classified as a lifetime registrant under the sex offender registry enters our community, and that's to identify them to our community members, let them know where they will be living, in hopes that with that information, the citizens are armed with the information that can keep them and members of their family safe. In the case of Turner, he indicated that once he was released from Racine Correctional, he wanted to return to Madison and live in a low-cost hotel somewhere along the Beltline, and since that touched a number of communities, we wanted to make sure that each of the chiefs were notified and that they were present when we made that notification to our greater Dane County community.
Sheriff Mahoney, you had mentioned that that Gerald Turner will have to register as a sex offender if released. Tell us exactly what that means as far as what he's able to do, where he's allowed to go, and so on.
Well, as a registrant, he'll be required to wear a GPS bracelet, which will be monitored by Department of Corrections. And since, you know, there won't be somebody assigned specifically to him, he'll be one of many who are being monitored. Now, that's really the extent of his supervision. The fact that he'll wear a GPS bracelet, he can continue to go where he wishes. There are some restrictions as they relate to schools and daycare centers and things of that nature, but the fact that he'll be on the bracelet only allows us to access his whereabouts when we're monitoring him. And I understand staffing levels, et cetera, that won't be in real time, so to speak. Yeah. And so that's concerning. I might point out that we've had numerous notifications in the community of individuals who are registrants who have sought out treatment programs while incarcerated and who have very successfully reintegrated back into the community without offenses.
Well, that was actually going to be my next question, because certainly this isn't the only sex offender released into the community, into Dane County, that you're going to see this year. Happens that this case is fairly high profile, but you know, have you seen, you know, is it your experience that registered sex offenders recommit crimes or lose their opportunity, you know, end up being reincarcerated because of similar crimes that got them into jail in the first place?
Well, you know, a lot of the success is based upon whether, first of all, there's an acknowledgement of their crime, and then second, seeking out treatment opportunities while incarcerated to address those offenses. If an individual, based on my experience, if an individual follows that model, they are generally very successfully reintegrated back into the community. If they don't acknowledge and don't seek out treatment, as I think we've seen with Turner now, with his reoffense soon after he was released on probation, that there very well may be a continued threat to the community and a likelihood of reoffending. And I have not talked to the Attorney General, but I believe that is the justification behind Attorney General Schimmel seeking a 980 commitment.
We're talking to the Sheriff of Dane County, Dave Mahoney, about the possible release of Gerald Turner into Dane County. He's indicated that he would like to he'd like to live in Dane County once released. He was due for release on Wednesday, but he's still incarcerated, pending a decision as to whether he is it's safe for him to be released, that the Attorney General has asked for a ruling on that. So most cases involving convicted sexual offenders are nowhere near as high profile as this one, as we've pointed out before. How do neighborhoods and communities change when a registered sex offender moves in?
Well, I think it goes to the awareness that individual is in the community. I think that, by and large, communities are cautious, but it's the notifications that maintain that level of safety. Law enforcement can't do it alone, so it's my philosophy to make the community notifications to include a photograph of the individual, the location that they will be living at, the restrictions, in hopes that the community can assist law enforcement in the monitoring of that individual. Should they violate, help us by making that awareness and making that notification if they find that individual in violation of their conditions of release.
Are there concerns the other way, that with such a high-profile case like this, you know, that he's got a nickname and his offense was against a 9-year-old girl that he raped and murdered, that he may actually have safety issues of his own person by moving into a community where people know where he lives?
Well, that's always a potential possibility. We had an incident several years ago in Cottage Grove when a sex offender was being relocated to a residence in that community, and a community member on their own struck out with vigilante attempts and burned the house down. They were also critically injured themselves in that process, but that's an example of the extremes that can occur when somebody's relocated to a community.
Sheriff, any parting words that you'd want people to know about sexually violent people or law enforcement's approach to them?
Well, you know, the requirement for notification is based upon the individual sheriff for each county. It's my philosophy to make that notification to our community. I think by and large, most communities are understanding but not open-armed welcoming of these individuals in the community. But we have to understand that not everybody who's incarcerated in our prisons can be held for their entire lives.
Sheriff Mahoney, thank you for joining us. Dave Mahoney is the Dane County Sheriff. Coming up, we'll talk more broadly about the law called Turner's Law that provides a way for the state to hold certain convicts beyond the end of their sentences. You're tuned to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Wisconsin's Attorney General Brad Schimmel is holding Halloween killer Gerald Turner in prison, even though his sentence ended on Wednesday. He's making use of a Wisconsin law called Chapter 980, which allows the state to keep inmates incarcerated past their sentence if they're found to be a danger to be released in the community. Joining us to talk about that law is Cecilia Klingel. She is the Assistant Professor of Law at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and a faculty associate at the UW Law School's Frank J. Remington Center. She's an expert on criminal law, criminal justice administration, sentencing and correctional policy, and community supervision. Are you comfortable with Gerald Turner being released, or should he be committed? Should an offender be released after serving their sentence, or do you think the state should be allowed to block their freedom? If you're interested in joining our conversation, you can call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org or tweet at WPR Mornings. We welcome our guest, Cecilia Klingel. Good to have you with us today.
Thank you for inviting me.
We don't want to focus too much on Gerald Turner in the rest of this hour, but rather some of the issues behind that case. So explain for us, if you can, what Wisconsin's Chapter 980 law is.
This law, and more than 20 states have similar laws, as does the federal government, says that once a person has finished serving a sentence for a sex crime, if that individual is diagnosed with a mental health condition that makes it likely that the individual will sexually reoffend, that person can be civilly committed as a patient for the purpose of giving him, or theoretically her, treatment that would reduce that risk and allow the person eventually to be safely returned to the community.
And the burden of proof for that mental condition is on the state, correct?
It is. So the state needs to prove both that the mental health condition exists and that it makes the person likely to commit the offense, that it's more likely than not. But they have to persuade a jury that that's true beyond a reasonable doubt.
So the state thinks an offender, if the state thinks an offender hasn't been reformed by the time their sentence is up and may commit another violent sexual act, how does that Chapter 980 process go into effect?
So there's a lot of procedure behind the decision to seek civil commitment, and it's important to emphasize that it's a very, very small fraction of sex offenders whom the state seeks to detain after the sentence is completed. So according to the Department of Corrections, approximately a quarter of the current population is incarcerated with a sex offense. That means that there are almost 6,000 people in the Wisconsin prison system right now who may have sex offenses on their record, but there are fewer than three, or roughly 300 people at any given time who are civilly committed as sexually violent persons under the law. So it's a very small fraction. And in order to determine who might be an appropriate candidate for civil commitment, there is review prior to the end of the criminal sentence by individuals at the prison. If there's a reason to think that someone might be an appropriate candidate, then there has to be a probable cause hearing to decide whether the person should then be sent to the Division of Human Services, which would do a more complete and thorough workup and review to decide if a person ought to be detained. And then the individual is entitled to a trial to decide whether he or she will be civilly committed.
Now, in this particular case that we're talking about, the Gerald Turner case, we didn't hear about Attorney General Schimmel's efforts to impose Chapter 980 until just a few days before his release was scheduled. Is it normal that that would be so late? Here's a fellow in this particular case, 39 of the past 43 years he's been incarcerated, that this question would come up so late in the sentence. Would that review normally happen, 6 months out, 12 months out, or would it be right up until the end of the time that the person was to be released?
Can't be filed under the law until there's 90 days or less remaining on the sentence.
Okay.
So you're really looking at the formal legal proceedings gearing up in those final months prior to release, in part because, at least theoretically, what we want to do is see how someone is faring in prison, whether the individual is participating in treatment programs, what the individual's behavior looks like, to get a sense of which individuals ought to be released in the normal course of things and which may be suffering from some more significant problems that make them a really significant risk to the public.
Our guest is a faculty associate at the UW Law School's Frank J. Remington Center, Cecilia Klingel. And we're talking about a Chapter 980, which is a portion of the law that allows the state to hold violent sexual offenders after their prison sentence is over if they feel they can convince a judge that the inmate has mental problems that might cause them to recommit. Your number to call us is 800-642-1234 if you'd like to join the conversation or ask a question. 800-642-1234. Let's turn to the phones now and talk to Steve in Sun Prairie. Steve, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. First a comment. I think the spirit of our country is that once you serve your sentence, whatever that sentence is, you should be, let out into the public again. However, I understand the concept. If there's a strong sense or that you're mentally incompetent and you would definitely do that crime again, I get the idea of holding it. But my question is this really just a sham? How often does somebody go to this court that you guys talked about, and the position is, yes, they can go out in the public? Or is it just a sham that says once the state says they're going to invoke this, they're just going to be in prison regardless of what this court says, because it's simply just a sham?
Cecilia Klingel, do you have a sense of how often the state is successful what percentage of the time the state would be successful imposing when it asks for this sort of ruling?
So I don't have the specific Wisconsin statistics on what percentage of the time people are, in fact, being committed when the state is seeking it. Though my understanding is the case you were discussing earlier this hour actually is an example of a time when an individual went to jury trial. The state sought to commit him earlier in his life and failed to do so, and is now attempting to do so again based on developed information. But what I can say is that across the country, there's been a lot of debate over whether this is really just a way to enhance sentences and hold people longer than judges thought was appropriate. And across the country, we see really different patterns in terms of whether states are detaining people in inpatient facilities for their whole life, whether they are detaining them and then letting a certain number go back into the community or discharging them completely, or whether, as in Texas, most people who are civilly committed are actually in community treatment with pretty intensive supervision rather than behind bars. In Wisconsin, as I mentioned, at any given time, we have roughly, and these are the statistics from around 2015, which is the most recent I was able to obtain, around 300 people who are detained behind bars in the Sandridge Secure Treatment center, and then about 50 who are being evaluated at any given time to decide whether they ought to be committed. And then we have roughly, I think, 50 to 60 individuals who are on supervised release in the community. So they're still under the supervision of the Division of Health Services, but they are able to reside in community settings and have access to work and other liberties. But certainly your caller's concerns about whether this is at odds with our general sense that once someone has been punished, the sentence is discharged, is a big source of national debate and conversation.
Thank you, Steve. Let's move to Matt in Green Bay with his comment or question. Matt, thanks for joining us. Hello, Matt. You're on. Okay, we lost Matt, it sounds like. That's okay. We'll move on. Now, so Chapter 980, also known as Turner's Law, only applies to sexual offenders, not to murderers, not to armed robbers, not to drug dealers, or anyone else. Why are sexual offenders in a class by themselves?
That's a hard question to answer, and I think it relates to the way in which, at least at this moment in our history, sex offenses capture the imagination and I think play on our fears and vulnerabilities in a way that other crimes, even murder perhaps, does not. The interest in sexual offenders and concerns about their reoffense isn't new. Back in beginning and actually as early as the 1930s, but particularly in the 1950s and 60s, there were sexual psychopath laws that were passed by about 26 states that allowed individuals who were thought to be sexually violent not to be sentenced in a traditional prison at all, but rather to be civilly committed. There were a lot of concerns that the kind of treatment those individuals were receiving were wholly ineffectual and abusive, really. And in the 1970s, 1980s, we saw most of those laws repealed. That was happening at the same time. We were also seeing the general deinstitutionalization of a lot of individuals who were being civilly committed for other mental health problems as well. And then it was in the 1990s that these laws sort of saw resurgence, first in the state of Washington and then throughout the country. And as I said, we now have more than 20 states and the federal government involved in the commitment of civilly violent persons. In some states, they're called sexually violent persons or predators. Mm-hmm. And the way that is happening now isn't in lieu of a sentence. People are being placed in these commitments after they've already served a prison term.
Yeah. Have there been any efforts that you're aware of, either in Wisconsin or around the country, to impose a Chapter 980-type law toward offenders of non-sexual crimes?
I have not heard of any such efforts. The reality is this is a very, very expensive process.
I would bet.
And while there are certainly true believers who think that these interventions can make a significant difference in reducing people's risks, there are also plenty of skeptics who are concerned that, in fact, we still don't know how to treat sexual offenses any better than we did in the 1950s and 60s. There's reason to think we have made progress, but not nearly as much as we might hope.
Let's move to Bill in River Falls. Bill, thank you for joining the morning show.
Hi, good morning. I have a question for you, for the law professor. My concern with any of these things is always the loss of due process, the loss of representation of the accused, or in this case, the convicted, in the eyes of the law, that somehow their strike against them will erode their ability to have access to the due process. What you said earlier about this judicial and court review makes it sound like the due process remains intact. And I was just wondering if you could comment on a check and balance within the system so that this sort of thing is not applied in a capricious manner based on, you know, the feeling or the zeitgeist or the emotions around a case, whether it's a sexual offender or not. You know, how you feel this may be consistent with due process, consistent of our constitutional protection. Thank you.
Sure. I mean, there is certainly plenty of process to go around when it comes to 980 commitments. So there are multiple layers of review and determination. As I said, there's a lot of sorting. It's not any individual who's committed a sexual offense or even any individual who's committed a sexually violent offense who is even eligible to be detained under this law. There has to be a diagnosis of a mental health condition that's linked to the risk of reoffense. Now, in reality, if you actually look at the diagnoses of the individuals who are detained, often they are predictive. I mean, you're looking at diagnoses of pedophilic disorder or paraphilic disorders of various kinds that are, of course, inherently linked to sexual behavior that is of concern to the public. That said, individuals who are subjects of petitions for commitment are given counsel. They have a full trial with a right to a jury. And as I said, ultimately, the state has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that it's more likely than not that because of their mental health condition, they're likely to sexually reoffend again. That, I think, takes care of the problems of procedure and process. I think there still are big questions that remain unanswered and are difficult to answer about the substance itself, whether it is right to detain individuals, not based on what they've done, but based on what we are afraid they might do in the future. And that's a much harder question to answer.
And it seems to be one that we particularly place on sexual offenders based on this Chapter 980.
Yes.
The particular case that triggered this conversation, the Gerald Turner case. Gerald Turner was due for he's known as the Halloween killer. He was convicted of rape and murder of a 9-year-old girl that happened on Halloween night back in 1973. He was due for release this past Wednesday. The Attorney General is imposed Chapter 980 to begin the process to evaluate whether he should be released. My question is it unusual that it would be at the level of the Attorney General to actually make this request, or is that something that's part of Chapter 980? Could other prosecutors make the request, or would it have to be coming from the top law enforcement officer of the state?
So in Wisconsin, the Department of Justice is typically charged with both making decisions about when to file petitions for civil commitment, and then their attorneys are the ones who prosecute those cases.
So this is not an unusual situation?
No, not in any way.
All right. Thank you. Our guest is Cecilia Klingel. She is an assistant professor of law at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and a faculty associate at UW Law School's Frank J. Remington Center. We're talking about Chapter 980 and learning more about what this process is that allows the state to request a hearing to possibly keep a prisoner behind bars who is accused of or who has been convicted of sexual assault, to keep that prisoner behind bars after their sentence is over. And that's what is being considered in the case of Gerald Turner. We'll be back with more in a bit. I'm Dean Kallenbach, and this is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. Wisconsin's Attorney General's office is fighting against the release of Gerald Turner, the man known as the Halloween killer. We're looking at Wisconsin's Chapter 980 law, which allows the state to commit offenders who are considered to be sexually violent after serving their prison sentences. And our guest today is an expert on criminal law, Criminal Justice Administration, Sentencing and Correctional Policy, and Community Supervision, Assistant Professor of Law at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, Cecilia Klingel. And we are going to ask you how you'd feel about having a violent sexual offender moved into your neighborhood. What questions or opinions do you have about Wisconsin's sexually violent person law? Call 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org, or tweet at WPR Mornings. We return to chatting with Cecilia Klingel, and we're wondering, this Halloween killer case we're talking about, very high profile, really not the norm. How often is this Turner's Law, or Chapter 980, applied in Wisconsin?
So, as I mentioned, not terribly frequently, right? We have a total population at Sandridge of committed individuals that hovers roughly around 300. That number has changed over time. In the first years of the law, we were seeing a growing number of individuals every year being committed. That peaked in the early, the latter part of the first decade of this century. So around 2008-2009, we saw a maximum population of 387 patients. These are not prisoners, right? They've served their sentences, so we call them patients being treated. And then as our understanding of the risk of reoffense of sex offenders has grown nationally and internationally through continued research, we began to realize that some of the people who were committed weren't actually as at much risk as we believed them to be. And so there were individuals who were released to the community, and we've come off that high number and are now, as I said, hovering around 300.
Mary from Janesville emails, if Mr. Turner was convicted of murder, why is he not serving a mandatory life sentence? And also, what crimes in Wisconsin require locking people up for life? I'm not entirely sure. As I looked through the materials, I couldn't find it said he was convicted of homicide, but it didn't say it was first degree, which I think is a mandatory life sentence. And I would imagine that the case was something less than that for him to get. His original sentence was 38 years. Question I have, well, let's, I tell you what, let's move, because I think John has a similar question to ask. John in Green Bay is on the line, and John, thank you for joining us on the morning show.
Yeah, thank you very much. I would like to connect what you've been talking about with an individual known as David Spanbauer. Mm-hmm. This was a person who had raped a babysitter, and then when the father came home, shot the father in the face. Now, to me, those crimes would have been, in my opinion, sufficient for life imprisonment. But they weren't, you know, they weren't made.
Yeah, and Cecilia Klingel, we don't always see life imprisonment when it seems, looking in from the outside to these cases, especially cases that get a lot of publicity, like the Spanbauer case, like the Gerald Turner case. These are cases where, you know, as we read in the paper the details of what they're accused of, it's hard to imagine why they should ever, walk outside of prison again. What's the reason that not all these end up with life sentences?
Well, I think it's first important to remember that many of the cases we're talking about are old cases. The Turner case is from the 1970s. Sentencing laws were very different then, and our sense of what amount of punishment someone deserved for an offense was different then. Throughout the 1980s and 1990s, American sentences skyrocketed in terms of their length and the number of cases we had where life sentences were imposed on individuals that didn't used to be nearly as prevalent as it is now. It's also important to remember that in Wisconsin, we've only had truth in sentencing laws since the year 2000. And before that, all sentences, or most of them except some homicide cases, were parole eligible. And so no one expected that their entire sentence would be served behind bars. We knew that there would be a portion of the sentence at the back end that would be served in the community under close supervision. And so why 38 years was the sentence and not 45 or some other number is I can't answer, not knowing the details of the sentencing or the background of the defendant, because the crime is one factor that we look at when sentencing someone. We also look at the individual and the individual's life circumstances too. But for whatever reason, the sentence was one that was parole eligible. And in fact, in the 1970s, I would have expected most sentences, including homicide sentences, to have had parole eligibility at some point.
In the case of Gerald Turner, you're looking at a person who sexually assaulted a 9-year-old and of course, killed her as well. How much more difficult is it to mentally treat an offender who preys on children as opposed to adults? Or are they just treated differently but aren't necessarily more difficult?
I think it's important to notice that not all sex offenders are the same, right? We use that label, and it's a really scary one, and it can mean a lot of different things depending on the context in which it's used. And certainly the dynamics that drive offending behavior and the factors that are relevant for treatment are going to vary depending on many, many factors, including the age of a preferred victim. It's important to notice, too, I think, that even for that very tiny group of individuals who are civilly detained at Sandridge, so these are individuals whom we have reason to believe are particularly dangerous in their propensities, the treatment facility has four completely different tracks of treatment, depending on the characteristics of the individual person. There are individuals who are confined there who assault primarily adults. There are those who have pedophilia. There are individuals with significantly limited cognitive functioning and learning disabilities. There are also particularly high-functioning individuals. There are those with psychopathy and those without psychopathy. So the reality is that the details of the individual's own mental functioning and criminal history are going to be particularly varied. And while we are learning more about how we can effectively engage with individuals and to try to change patterns of offending behavior, the reality is that we don't have a lot of magic answers, and that engaging individuals, particularly those with other challenges like substance addiction and low functioning, takes a lot of resources, and it's not clear how effective we can be in providing them with treatment.
And what I'm hearing, though, is that not one size fits all.
No, not ever. And that's true not just for sex offenses, that's true for any criminal behavior. The reality is that, you know, people aren't widgets, and we all have complex histories that lead us to behave in the ways that we do. And intervening to change those patterns often takes a lot of work and a lot of resources.
This is a big question, but how should states, including Wisconsin, handle sexually violent people to minimize the chances of them committing similar crimes down the road? What states would you say are doing it right when it comes to dealing with these kinds of offenders?
I don't know that I have an answer to that question because, you know, the devil's in the details, and I'm not sure that I'm privy to enough of them to be able to say that one place stands out as a model. I think as a general rule, particularly for people who are not prisoners, who are not being punished under the law, we should be careful to try to give those individuals as much liberty as we think is reasonably possible. Important to notice that in any other context, for any offense other than sexual offending, we only allow civil commitment in cases where someone poses an imminent threat of harm to herself or to those around her. Mm-hmm. And we tend to try to limit the amount of time we take individuals out of the community and keep it as short as possible and whenever possible to provide them with the support and treatment and supervision they need in a community-based setting. And I think that that's a good impulse, and it's a good impulse to have no matter what the crime of conviction is. That said, again, it takes a lot of resources to do that well, and it also takes public support and buy-in. And again, the fear we have of sex offenders is extraordinarily great. If you look at popular culture and media, it often plays to that fear. And while, of course, we have to take crime risks seriously, the point you made earlier that we don't behave in the same way when someone's committed homicide, I think is something for us to pause and reflect on. And we ought to be thinking about whether, whenever possible, we're providing people with a dignified, respectable way to live out their lives once their punishment time is over, that keeps them as safe as they can be kept, and for us too, but that also acknowledges the freedom that they've earned from having served their sentences.
Cecilia Klingel, thank you for joining us this morning.
My pleasure.
Cecilia Klingel is an expert on criminal law, criminal justice administration, sentencing and correctional policy, and community supervision. She's assistant professor of law at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and a faculty associate at UW Law School's Frank J. Remington Center. Earlier, we talked with Dane County Sheriff Dave Mahoney. This hour was produced by Bill Martins and Keely Bultina, with technical direction by executive producer Michelle Johnson. This is The Morning Show. I'm Dean Kallenbach in for Kate Archer Kent on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.